This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. Should a river or glacier be considered a legal person? International courts have already granted such status. What does that mean and what should we think about it? Ken discusses that issue today on this podcast. Now, Ken, let's put it in the best possible light before people get overly worked up about it. The courts are trying to protect the environment for some of the local people groups, as I understand it from the article you passed along to us. So you have some local tribes that have seen their territory be eroded away or what have you. So these glaciers, which have meant so much to them over a long period of time, have gone to deterioration. So the courts have stepped in and said, we want to help these people out. So let's try to put it in the best possible light as you place this in a larger context.
That's right. Well, we live in a world where we, I think, now appreciate that natural resources need to, they need supervision, they need to be protected. And so environmentalism has, I think, in some respects, served humanity well. And so what we have is a movement in both India and New Zealand, not only to protect rivers and glaciers, but to actually grant them the status of personhood. So, you know, whatever you think about environmentalism, and Christians have differing perspectives on how green we should go. And so you have, you know, Christians arguing for more environmentalism. You have others on the spectrum who think environmentalism has gone too far. But yeah, I think the place to begin is a recognition that, you know, with advanced technology, we realize that there is limited space here on planet Earth. There are only so many, you know, unpolluted rivers and things of that nature. And as we talk about this topic in two programs, I think there's enough content to extend it into a second program. I want to talk later about the way I think Christians can and should look at creation. Now, I'm going to propose, Joe, that this is extreme environmentalism. This is not merely a concern that nature be protected and preserved so that people in the future can, you know, enjoy all of these wonderful sights. But I think it is an extreme form. And what I mean by that is that they've actually granted, both in India and New Zealand, and of course there are questions, could this extend to other places, including the United States of America,
right,
where you would actually grant natural entities the legal status of being persons? Now, I was interviewed for World Magazine on this, so you might see something, our listeners might see something coming on that topic. But I think what we actually do see is kind of the environmentalist movement moving to the mystical side of life. But before I get onto that, I do want to read bits and pieces from a couple articles that came my way. This is an interesting little news magazine. It's called Evolution News and Science Today. And the title of the article, Now It's Personhood for Glaciers. This is Wesley J. Smith. He says, environmentalism is going mad. In the process, it's becoming dangerous to human thriving and to our metaphysical self-perception. Now, I'm assuming here that Wesley J. Smith writing for a news article with the title Evolutionary News and Science Today. I'm assuming Davey's secular in orientation, but notice that he expresses some concern. He says, last week I wrote about rivers being declared persons. Now in India, glaciers have been similarly declared living entities. Specifically, a court has declared that rivers of ice have the rights of legal persons. And he goes on to say, this is anti-science. Glaciers are physical phenomena. They are not alive. But who cares, right? Postmodernism strikes a beat into our life. It will seep, narratives rule now. And he continues, he says, so do glaciers have the right not to melt? Will the glaciers thus be able to sue to prevent human actions that might be perceived to cause melting or otherwise impact the ice, boulders, rocks, and dirt and make up glaciers? Can the trees sue not to be cut? Can ponds sue not to be drained? Understood that the rights of glaciers will be enforced by appointed committees made up of people of a particular ideological bent. Human exceptions need not apply. He closes the very brief article by saying, if nature has rights, everything in the world does. Flora, fauna, microscopic, geological, gases. Boy, do gases have rights? That sucks the power and meaning from the crucial concepts of rights. And he says this, he says, it also means that human beings cannot be considered of unique and special value. Our lives cannot be said to have greater meaning. Now, that's an interesting point of view because, again, I'm assuming, and I you have to be careful when you assume things, but writing for a little online news article entitled or news magazine called Evolutionary News and Science Today, I'm assuming here that Mr. Smith or Dr. Smith, I'm not sure what his title is, I think Joe and Dave, he's secular,
It might be from the Discovery Institute.
Okay. Well, that would put a very now that I look over here on the side with Stephen Meyer and Jay Richards, that might be right. That's still kind of an interesting news article. Well, so if it's Christian, that would put it into a new slant. But it is interesting to raise the question, do natural entities have the status of personhood? Now, here is another little online magazine. It's entitled New Zealand River Has the Rights of Personhood. It says, in a landmark case for the rights of nature, officials in New Zealand granted the Wanagani, I don't know if I have that even pronounced close to right, the nation's third longest river with legal personhood in the same way a company is, which will give it rights and interests. The decision follows a long court battle for the river's personhood initiated by the Wanagani River, an indigenous community with strong cultural ties to the waterway. Under the settlement, the river was regarded as a protected entity under an arrangement in which representatives of both the iwi and the national government will serve as legal custodians toward the Waganami's best interest. Well, let me raise this issue. How should we think about the idea of environmentalism actually granting rights to natural entities?
Well, there is a sense in which you can try to understand why are they doing this. I mean, you could imagine they're doing it because they really believe, like they have an animist sort of viewpoint. Rocks and trees and rivers and glaciers actually have some spirit in them, sort of a supernatural kind of viewpoint. The other is to just think about it in terms of here's an individual that wants to protect the environment, wants to protect a river from being polluted. And there's all kinds of various laws that have been put in place to do that, but are ineffective. They somehow are, you know, set aside. And so if a factory can be put down and pour out junk and pollute the river with impunity. Or maybe they've been doing it for years, and so, you know, if they tried to stop them, the jobs would be lost. Or, and so, how, you know, here you are, an environmentalist, I want to protect that river. What degree, how far do I have to go in order to get this to a point to where these people can't do this, can't destroy this river? And so they get a court to make this river having a status of personhood, and now it allows them, the river or people, representatives of the river, to sue these companies or these individuals that are doing things that pollute the river, where they couldn't do that before.
I guess I, as a philosopher, I actually take them at their word. I actually think they're attributing personhood to physical objects.
So they're kind of following the first path that I described.
Yeah, and of course the question I have is, so the baby inside the womb doesn't have the right of personhood, but a river and a glacier does. I actually think radical environmentalism is going mystical. I want to develop that idea a little bit, but I think the other interpretation you're offering, Dave, is, look, we don't think these rivers and glaciers are actually living beings, but we haven't really been able to protect them, so we're going to
take this,
we're going to manufacture this provocative idea to try to protect them.
Right.
Okay, that's a possibility, but I think environmentalism has gone off the cliff. I mean, that's my view. I actually think that they are actually attributing things to these people. But let's develop the idea a little bit. Now, here is kind of a way of giving consideration to this. You have a large number of religions. They're given various names. Sometimes they're called basic religions. Sometimes they're called primal religions. A more negative term is seen as primitive religion. And these make up a large number of people in the world. I mean, so we're talking, Joe, the native religions of Africa, the native religions of Australia, North America, South America, Asia, and these would be religions that go back very, very far. We would call them primitive, and I don't think the term there is meant to be derogatory as much as it is these are the early religions of human beings. Now, often they're called primal religion, and Dave alluded to the idea that one of the ideas that is part of these basic religions, and by the way, I think it was Stephen Neal, who is Dr. Neal was an expert on the world's religions. He was an Anglican, spent 40 years as a missionary in India. He knows a lot about these kind of early religions. Neal says that 40% of the people on the planet hold to something like a primal religion. Now, what he means by that, and I'll read a little bit from him a little bit later, but what Neal, I think, meant by all of that was that even many of the world's religions, see, I would put them in different categories. I would say world religions are, you know, Baha'ism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism and Confucianism and Christianity and Islam, etc. Those are the world's religions. Those are typically thought as historical religions, although there are parts of some of those religions that might go back very early. But Neal's point here is that even a lot of people who believe in the world's religions really practice primal religions. They think nature is alive. They think nature is alive with spirits and you know, things of that nature. And Neil, I think, and others would even go so far as to say there may be even branches of Christendom that believe that. And for example, there are areas in which Catholicism has kind of a mixture of Spiritism and things of that nature. So Neil is suggesting that behind even the world's religions, you have a lot of people who believe that nature is alive. Well, let me read a little bit here from a book entitled Religions of the World by Lewis Hopfe. This is a very popular book that's used in courses on world religions. He defines animism. He says, Sir Edward Taylor theorized that people originally envisioned the world as being alive with souls or spirits, and on the basis of this understanding of nature developed religion. So this is kind of a naturalistic explanation. Sir Edward Taylor said the first religions were animistic, believing that nature is filled with spirits, and then out of that came the more traditional religions. Well, that's a very secular way of thinking about religion. I thought maybe God might have something to do with it, but Hopfe goes on to say, he says, indeed, the belief that nature is alive with spirits that have feelings and can be communicated with is one of the most common to human religious experience. In many basic religions, people believe that they are not the only spirit, that animals, trees, stones, rivers, mountains, heavenly bodies, the seas, and the earth itself have anima, spirit. It is also believed that these spirits communicate, can be flattered or offended, and can either help or hurt humans. These spirits are therefore believed to be personal. The development of technology and the spread of historical religions have not eliminated these beliefs. Many Christians, Muslims, and Buddhists believe that spirits have the ability to bless or alternatively curse human beings. Now, the point I want to make here is I want to raise this question. If animus, and this is, a primal or basic or a common belief held by the Native Americans here in the United States, but also in other parts of the world, South America, Africa, and Asia, if they believed that spirits were imbued in all of these natural entities, the question then is raised, maybe the animus would be the perfect environmentalists, because they think these entities, mountains and seas and waters, that they're alive. And so wouldn't the more early religions kind of be the perfect environmentalists? I don't think that this is merely a political way of getting around the polluters in the world. Dave, you and I might differ on this. I'm not sure what your view is. I don't think that this is merely a way of trying to keep people from polluting the river. I actually think the environmental movement has shifted to more of a mystical idea.
Well, I guess I would say only that certainly there are environmentalists that are not part of what you would call the radical movement.
Yes,
and are
yes.
just concerned about the environment.
That's
right. I mean, as a Christian, you know, God gave us the responsibility as human beings to protect the environment.
Stewardship.
Stewardship, exactly.
To watch over it, yeah. Now, let me read just a little bit more here. Here is another text. It's by Robert E. von Vroost, good Dutch name there. And he defines, he talks about primitive religion and primal religion. He has a little section on animism and totemism. He says animism and totemism are popular as labels for religions in some circles today. Animism, from the Latin anima, soul or spirit, is the belief that individual spirits exist not only in people, but also in individual things in nature, whether they appear to be alive or not. Individual animals, plants, rocks, thunder and lightning, mountains, lakes, and rivers. In many religions, the spirits are deceased. Humans keep a close relationship with the living so that they're part of myth and ritual. Well, my take on all of this is along these lines. I think that in the radical environmental movement, I think there's a shift toward mysticism. And I think the thought is that the primitive religions, the primal religions, would be the ideal keepers of the natural world because they saw them as alive. And if you, I wish I had this quotation. One scholar was saying that the Hebrews, he compares the Hebrews, the Greeks, and people living today. He makes this comment. I wish I could pull out of my memory the author of this, but he said that the Hebrews looked at the natural world in terms of reverencing the Creator. And he said the Greeks looked at the world to kind of analyze it and figure it out. And moderns are in the world to use it, right? So the idea is that people can look at nature and evaluate it very, very differently. Now, I would propose to you that you have to ground your beliefs in something. And I think in some respects, people look at the environmental world. We look at nature in very different ways. You could be a person who has a high degree of value on planet Earth, but be an atheist. Now, I think you would just say, well, the universe is here, but it is amazing, and it has value, if for no other reason than it is our habitat. But there are plenty of other people who see nature as alive, and they have they grant metaphysical and philosophical categories. Panpsychism, for example, is the view that material and physical objects have mind connected to them. Pantheism says that the universe is God, that there's one reality and that one reality is God. And so the universe is God. Other people embrace panentheism, which says the universe is kind of like God's body, if you will. Then there's mysticism, broadly defined as the idea that you can have a direct encounter with God, but I'm going to kind of expand it a little bit. I think what we see here in these articles reflects kind of the idea that nature is magical, that nature is spiritual in orientation. Then there's animism that we've talked about, goes back very far, that natural objects have spiritual entities connected with them. And then various forms of paganism or neo-paganism, that the natural world, is alive in orientation. So now the question is, if that is the case, that we'll grant rights, now, and go with me on this, let's take the position that they're not actually, that this isn't just a lawyer trick. Let's actually,
like I was suggesting.
Yeah, let's take it with that it's not an attempt to try to get a hold of those people that want to use and misuse and pollute and all of that. Let's suppose that they actually think that these things ought to be granted rights. Now here is the reason.
Now what we're saying is that the court is made up of judges who actually believe that then.
Well, and who are they advocating for?
Yeah, I mean, these judges would have to be ones who went along with this.
And who are their plaintiffs? Who are they representing?
Well, the judge, yeah, I mean, the judges,
the tribal,
of course,
people.
Well, the courts are.
But it's the tribal people that are bringing the claim. Right,
right.
So there is this connectedness. Now maybe the judges don't believe it, and maybe they're doing it for political pressures.
Okay.
But it is connected to the tribal people who actually believe these things are alive, right?
Yes.
Now, let's develop that idea just a little bit. What does that do to things like human exceptionalism? What happens? I mean, we live in a nation where about half the people don't think human beings in the womb of their mother have personal rights and have inherent dignity and value. Mm-hmm. And yet there is the idea that maybe we can give natural objects personhood. I mean, that's a very different way of kind of looking at the world when you begin to say, maybe natural objects themselves have rights to be protected. That's a very different point of view. Now, what's interesting in all of this is,
let me just make a few little interjections here. I'm just thinking about a court of law. The judges that are making decisions on, and they're not saying all rivers are persons. They're saying this particular river. I think along the lines that you were just saying, that particular river is important in the minds of the tribes that frequent or use or are part of that river. I mean, it's kind of like the land up there in Nebraska, is it? Where they want to put these oil pipes through, and the Indians are all up in arms about allowing that through there. And the courts, if they were going to follow this same precedent, they would say, hey, this we'll give in to the tribes' notions that this is somehow sacred. These tribes have been suppressed and mistreated for hundreds of years, and now we're going to give them throw a fish in their way by ruling that this land shouldn't be used for this purpose.
They didn't do that
in the case of Nebraska, but they apparently have done down in New Zealand, where they decided that this river somehow was worth giving protection to, giving in to their. Now the courts or the judges who are making this decision in some Supreme Court, I guess, it was kind of like our Supreme Court. I don't think they necessarily believed this, but they were willing to submit to the requirements or the needs of these people.
Dave, I think, though, what you need to appreciate is when you give something legal rights, then it can be backed up. When you say that something has legal rights, you're talking about serious business.
Yes,
now.
I agree.
Because if humans in the womb had legal rights, you couldn't have abortions.
That's correct.
So the idea here is it's not, in my view, it is not merely the idea that, well, we'll just kind of placate these tribal folk.
Isn't it? Abortion, the judges, I wouldn't necessarily say they believed all that those who were arguing for abortion believed, but they, for pragmatic reasons, they gave in to the society, as it were.
Yeah, I think maybe where we differ is I think you always have a worldview perspective behind it.
I guess I would think that we have been leading in this direction for hundreds of years.
Yeah, let me come back to an article here. It's written by Dan Story. Dan is an apologist. He wrote an article for the Christian Research Journal, "Are Animists Model Environmentalists?" I think what's happening here is at least the idea is being entertained that if you believe that nature is alive, then you are in the best position to want to preserve and protect nature.
Right.
If you think nature is filled with various spirits, then you'll be in an ideal position. This is what Dan Story says, and I think it's interesting. He says, from the earliest days of the modern environmental movement, American environmentalists have claimed that tribal societies are more ecologically sensitive than cultures embracing Christianity. They claim, moreover, that their intuitive environmentalism flows directly from their religious beliefs and practices. Animism is the religion of all tribal cultures worldwide. Now, I think what's happening here is that we now live in a world where people are considering alternative metaphysical points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the lawyers or courts have to do, they're representing a particular perspective that is a movement toward the magical, toward the mystical. And what's interesting, and Dan Story goes on to say this, he says, the fact is tribal people have rarely been model environmentalists and have often exploited nature. Nor does animism include doctrines that directly promote environmental ethics and stewardship. Although indigenous people throughout the world often express a deep respect and reverence for their natural surroundings, it is without a theological framework. Now, what I think is kind of interesting here is if we take this idea seriously, that an animistic point of view is going to be more protective, is going to view the natural world with greater value, I think they have mistaken animism. Because animism is a religious belief that says nature is filled with spirits, but a lot of those spirits are evil and harmful, and you need to placate them. You need to manipulate them. You need a shaman mm-hmm. who will come in, and he'll protect the tribe. So what Dan Story does in his article, Are Animus Model Environmentalists, he actually argues that that may not be the best philosophy or religious worldview actually to protect the natural environment, mm-hmm. that you'll have kind of this religious battle on your hands where people will come in and they may manipulate nature rather than protect nature.
Wow.
So this is... there's also an article here written by... let me see if I can pull that out of my stack of articles here. It's written by E. Calvin Beisner. It's called The Competing Worldviews of Environmentalism and Christianity. And Cal Beisner develops the idea that the environmental movement is always looking for kind of a foundation. And he also views it as a movement toward the mystical. That, you know, kind of the traditional understandings of creation, kind of the Judeo-Christian foundation, they're not seen as viable, or they're seen as kind of using or misusing nature, and maybe the more primal religions will have more of a green or friendly element in that kind of context. And so the issue that we have here is how are we to think about those kinds of issues? I think that we live in a world where alternative perspectives are being given greater consideration.
Multiculturalism.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're living in a world where people are asking the question, how am I to look at the natural world? I may look at it through the prism of kind of a traditional Judeo-Christian element, but I may look at it from a very mystical orientation. And if you look at the countries in which we're talking, rivers and glaciers, they're connected to India and New Zealand, where there is a long-standing, deep sense of mysticism, a strong sense that maybe the Western forces, maybe the Judeo-Christian elements have not been nearly as supportive or friendly of these kinds of things. So I think there's a lot happening here, and I think some of it is philosophy. Mm. I think some of it actually is metaphysics. I think that the environmental movement is always looking to ground itself somewhere. And I think on the part of some, the idea is maybe by moving to the mystical orientation, you know, we can find a defense for that. And so I think that this is very interesting, and I don't think it's any different than some of these other kind of points of view that we see nature as being alive in the orientation.
You know, Ken, one of the things that I wonder about, and I don't know if you want to get to this, is what exactly they mean by personhood when you're talking about a natural phenomenon. In the case of a glacier or a river, Dave, you're a scientist, glaciers melt, so sometimes you have nothing there. You know, you have what was a glacier,
yeah,
and now it's gone. In the case of a river, you have a long, long stretch. You have this part of it over here, that part of it over there. What if somebody takes some of it for their own use? What part of that river do you deal with as an entity, if it's a person? How do you deal with such an entity if it's considered a person? I don't know if the court cares to address that.
I'm not sure they do. I mean, I don't know if they'll have a metaphysician and a philosopher on the panel that can begin. But
they have the power now, right?
They do have the any time, and that's a point, Dave, that I want to come back to. I think once you get the law involved in something,
mm-hmm,
then you have the ability to coerce people and force them to live according to the dictates of the law.
I mean, that's right.
They can always protest and go to jail or cause a revolt. But once they have the authority of these kinds of things, then I think you have the power to enforce it. And I think the common sense questions begin to come. I mean, how would nature protest that they're being offended? And, you know, how would things that can change? I mean, when we think about personhood, at least philosophically, we think about something that has consciousness. We think about a being that can make decisions and can act. Now, obviously, this debate even comes to the human condition, and I want to spend a little time talking about that before we end our program. You know, there is the question about human beings. Do these tiny little humans in the womb of their mother, are they persons? Now that I think is a reasonable question. I don't think it's reasonable to say they're not human, because I think the scientific question is case closed. At the beginning of conception, they're human beings. But now the philosophical question that is raised, and I'm going to tie it to this context, are they persons? I mean, let me introduce you to Peter Singer. Peter Singer is a very well-known atheist philosopher, teaches at Princeton University. Joe, a reformed college in its heyday, right? A Christian school, one of the premier Christian schools in early America, and still Princeton Seminary is still a very influential theological institution for education. Peter Singer says this. He says that, look, why should we give so many rights to these unborn babies? Or, he even goes further, why give rights to infants that are born into the world? Their consciousness is not nearly as developed as maybe farm animals are. Farm animals are much further along when they're born into the world. Humans can't really communicate very much. They don't have all these capacities. And so Peter Singer develops the idea that maybe parents ought to have 2 years to decide whether they want to euthanize their baby or not.
Let that sink in, huh?
Now this is a worldview. Now a lot of people are going to think that Peter Singer is every bit as kooky as the people who undoubtedly think a lot of what's going on here, environmentalism, is kooky. Mm-hmm. But we know that it's a dangerous thing for a leading intellectual like Peter Singer at Princeton University to say that farm animals have more rights than human beings.
And that's no exaggeration when you say leading intellectual. I looked up his name a while back, and he's one of the most sought-after speakers in the world. He's been around for a long time.
Absolutely. Peter Singer is, and by the way, let me, since I'm kind of critical of him, I'm very critical of him, let me say that one thing I like about Peter Singer is I think he's trying to be true to his convictions. That is, I think Peter Singer is developed certain naturalistic, atheistic points of view and is trying to live out that particular worldview. I'm sure he and I would have real strong disagreements, but I think to the degree that any of us are noble, given our fallenness, I think Peter Singer is trying to say, well, this is my naturalistic worldview, and here are the implications of that. Mm-hmm. Now, so people look at what's happening here in India and in New Zealand, and there have been articles, could this come to the United States? Could we decide?
I believe there have been similar cases in South America as well.
So could we have a movement where people begin to say, hey, wait a second here. You know, you've got a lot of people who look at nature and they want to use it. They want to make money. They want to pollute. They don't really care a great deal about the natural environment. And that worldview of capitalism and, you know, advancing the human condition in terms of money, it hasn't worked out all that well. And by the way, there are plenty of people who think that the Christian worldview is part to blame. There are people in the environmental movement who say, look, the Christian worldview is anthropocentric. You talk about human beings as if they're unique, as if they're special, and so the natural world is kind of, you know, is kind of left out. Mm-hmm. Or they think that the Christian worldview kind of, you know, use the natural environment. It's something to be used rather than necessarily to be protected. Now, in our second program, I want to look at that question, hopefully, in a more honest and reflective point of view. And Dave, I think that you're right. I think the Christian perspective is, has been, and should be that we're caretakers. Mm-hmm. We're to superintend the natural world in which we live, and we're not there just to use it up and, you know, not give a great deal of care. But I want to come back to this idea when you begin to say that maybe there is, maybe nature needs to be preserved and protected, and we need to take environmentalism in a much greater, with much greater emphasis. My question as a philosopher is, and how do you ground that?
Exactly.
How do you ground that? Are you going to suggest that this is a mystical world? And I think we recognize that we live in a world where alternative points of view are taken very, very seriously. And I don't know, Joe, I don't know how you would address issues like, glaciers come apart and, waterways have all kinds of changes that take place within their context. And of course, the question that I really want to emphasize is, I'm not sure this is good for the world in which we live. I'm not sure this is good for human beings. It seems to me if we've gone any direction, we've gone in the direction of saying that that vulnerable human life isn't nearly emphasized as the natural world. So you have bumper stickers, save the whales. What about saving the unborn humans? Mm-hmm. Now is it an either or? Can I be a Christian? Can I care about environmental issues as a Christian and also care about, you know, the vulnerable condition of human beings? Of course, I think that's the case, but I actually think that that radical environmentalism has an agenda, and it's looking for a worldview to back it up. I don't think mysticism is the worldview. I think Dan Story in his article is correct. I don't think an animistic worldview would make everybody environmentally friendly. I think what you would have is a battleground between the spirits, and in effect, it would be control and manipulation. I think you need some theological safeguards, and I think those theological safeguards can be found within the Christian worldview. Hmm. I think that's where we can begin to say that nature has value, human beings have responsibility. So I take these things seriously. I think there is a pursuit of some kind of metaphysical grounding.
Do you think that the while the Christian worldview is the would be appropriate ground for this, it would seem to me that the only people who would really truly represent that worldview would be ones who are genuinely Christian?
Well, you know, I'll say this, Dave. Let's say you take the beliefs of people in the world. Let's say that the Pew Report says in 2050 there'll be 3 billion Christians, 3 billion Muslims, and 3 billion others, 3 mm-hmm. billion atheists,
whatever,
mixed with right. Hindus, etc. I mean, if you had a pantheist, and you had a naturalist atheist, and you had a Christian theist, how would they look at the world? How would they come down on issues like, how should we do environmentalism? What should be the driving force? Where does nature, if nature has value, is it inherent? Is it derived? I mean, if I were an atheist, how should I look at nature? Should I say, well, it's just there? Could I argue that let's use it? How would differing people, I mean, let me ask you this, Dave. How would a person at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, if they were a committed pantheist or embraced a mystical worldview, how would they do science? How would they necessarily kind of work at this? Or let's say you took a person who actually believed in animism. How would that affect their ways of thinking about science? So I do think the question of what do you believe about reality and where does the natural world get its value and purpose? I mean, I think what we see here is that these people are reflecting a worldview. And what I'm proposing is I'm not sure that animism or primal religion will actually ground environmentalism where nature really benefits. I'm thinking maybe the Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. worldview has a much more robust and maybe a more viable way of approaching those things. But I will say this, Joe, as we go into our next show, Christians don't all agree about environmentalism. The idea of moving green, there are different points of view, politically, theologically. Mm-hmm. Some people think Christians on the green side have lost their mind. Others think that we haven't done enough. We should be shifting much further. And so I'm not going to settle the question on environmentalism, but I think this is environmentalism unhinged, in my view.
Well, I'll take off my button that says every day is Earth Day. Sorry about that. Okay. We'll pick it up more on the next podcast. Thank you for your comments. Ken, we hope you have learned something on this one and invite you to listen on the next one. We'll continue the discussion. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.